You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 428 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, no longer home of the first place in the ALS Seattle Mariners. So I suppose...
Home of the Storm. Four-time WNBA champions.
Indeed it is.
And I'm coming to you from Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks, who are brawling! The fighting Seahawks.
That's a story we are not going to talk about on today's podcast.
Wait, really?
I mean, are we? I don't know. I think it's like wildly overplayed.
Okay. Well, we could talk later about whether it's wildly
overplayed. Players get in fights and during training camp and film at 11. That's training camp.
I feel like there have been a greater quantity of fights. I'm not saying this is a negative. I think the issue is that people are maybe painting. I don't even know if they are. It's just a thing that's happening, but they're brawling.
It was surprising that there were so many reports of it today.
This is the most I've ever heard people talking about fights at Seahawks training camp.
I agree with that. But also, I think people are talking more about things at training camp in every regard. Because just like no one was talking about, there was no live play-by-play of training camp in 1992.
But I'm sure that's what I'm comparing it to. I'm comparing it to the Pete Carroll era, obviously. I'm not comparing it to 1992.
I'm just saying, it's overplayed. I can't. But you know what I can?
My favorite thing about the story, this is the last we can talk about. My favorite thing about it is it is one of those stories that you, however you want to argue it, could go either way. You could be like, this team has that dog in them, they're ready to fight this year, or this team is completely separate.
But you've just expressed, explained every bit of training camp coverage, because it's like, wow, the defense got a lot of stops, but boy, the offense wasn't doing anything. Like, everything in training camp is by definition a zero-sum game, which is why...
I don't know if that... You can't be like, Geno Smith's injured.
Oh, fine. Yes, injuries are not... Geno Smith's healthy now.
I know, but still, there are things that happen in training camp.
I'm not saying that nothing that happens in training camp matters. I'm just saying that training camp results are a zero-sum thing that are like reported so breathlessly, except when you play, when you scrimmage against another team, which the Seahawks will be doing.
There we go.
Next week.
Feel like playing the Seahawks secondary, won't it? Anyway, let's talk about football later.
What I can do is toasts.
Hello.
An Olympic-themed toast this week, starting with the congratulations to the four Huskies, plus Coach Michael Callahan, who won bronze in eight-man rowing at the Olympics, the first medal for the USA in the event since 2008. I believe there are a total of 11 UW alums in total who won medals in the rowing event. But those four in particular are part of the same team, coached by UW's head coach. So,
only bronze, though? I thought we were the best rowers in the entire world.
In 1936, we were.
I was off by a year or two.
Again, I don't know about which other events the USA has won gold in, but first medal for the USA in that event since 2008. So they had gone three.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, three Olympiads without them. So it's been a minute.
I think that would qualify as dog's house.
Speaking of bronze, congrats to Kashmir's Haley Van Lith, who won bronze as part of the USA 3x3 women's basketball team. They undoubtedly celebrated with all sorts of applets and cutlets.
Hello.
Elsewhere on the basketball front, congrats to Australia and USA on advancing to the semifinals of the Olympic women's basketball tournament, where Jewel Loyd and the U.S. women will square off against Ezzie Magbegor, Sammy Whitcomb, Lauren Jackson, and the Opals for a spot in the final. That's coming up. That semifinal will be Friday morning, 8:30 a.m. Pacific time.
I've got some horrible news.
What? Is it about applets and collets?
No, I looked up University of Oregon Olympians.
Oh, I suspect there are a few of those in the track and field program.
There are six. This is just a Wikipedia page, so I don't. But there is one, Cole Hawker, who appears to have won gold.
Yeah. People were very excited about the Cole Hawker gold.
Oh, you're aware of this? I know no Olympic news. You know what I learned this week about the Olympics?
What's that?
The pommel horse. No horse. That's where I'm at. I'm not even joking. Oh, they were like this person on the pommel horse, and I'm like, so where does the horse come in?
I mean,
this feels like a bit, but it is not.
This feels like a bit, but it's not. It's a great Pelton Cast segment. I don't know if I could have specifically articulated what a pommel horse was, but I was pretty aware that they did not just bring a horse onto the mat during a gymnastics meet.
I didn't know it was a gymnastics thing. There are horse events. It's not like it's crazy.
It's true. There is equestrian, yes. I learned about the origin of the pommel horse, which is apparently that they used it to practice like jumping on and off of horses. It's a military origin.
So people are excited about this Cole Hawker gold medal?
I believe, if I recall correctly, he came from behind. I don't know. I didn't see the race, but I remember hearing about it.
Not usually a thing that Oregon's very good at.
Well, they used to be very good at track and field before we hired their coach. Oh. I don't know.
I've got one missed field goal to prove it.
We heard a story. So there was a Discord meetup the other night at Ravenna Brewing. Shouts to Third Pelton brother Noah Cohen for arranging it and to everybody who came out. We heard from a friend of the pod, Chris Wheeler, that he, because he lives near Husky Stadium, heard the celebration of Husky fans of the missed field goal before he actually saw it on TV.
Wow.
Amazing outcome to get spoiled by real life.
That's awesome.
All right, a congrats to Seattle native Blake Snell, who threw his first career no-hitter Friday versus Cincinnati.
It's also his first career complete game also, right?
Was it? Very rarely are there complete games that aren't no-hitters at this point. It's got to be a pretty high percentage of them. But a remarkable turnaround to Blake Snell's season after a rough start.
Let me give you a remarkable turnaround. Me explaining who Blake Snell is to Jan, because it happened on Friday while I was with Jan. Explaining to Blake Snell or to Jan who Blake Snell is, and then also explaining how Blake Snell is related to children's baseball and myself. It was not an easy feat. I definitely guarantee you that she could not articulate it after. It was like a 40-minute conversation where I'm like, this is here, this is there. She's like, he coaches children's baseball and is playing, so he's retired. He was on the Mariners. And I was like, Jan, I'm going to have to draw a map.
That's what it sounds like, yes.
Yeah, so I'm the one who deserves the toast for explaining to Jan who Blake Snell is.
I don't know that I'm going to toast that. But I am going to toast to J. Michael Kelly in the U1 Beacon Electric for winning Sunday's Apollo Mechanical Cup Trophy on Lake Washington. It's the fourth consecutive Seafair win for Kelly dating back to 2019. Wow. And his sixth career Seafair win, all within the last 9 races. That accounts for a third of Kelly's 18 career unlimited wins.
Wow, shouts to Kent Washington.
So he loves his home course. For the second consecutive week, as we get into our Seafair recap, a perfect set of heat races did not translate into a final heat win. This time it was Kelly's strong racing teammate and childhood friend Corey Peabody who won all 3 heats, beating national high points leader Andrew Tate in the U91 in their only head-to-head meeting. And then Tate had a very eventful final involving strong racing in the pre-race milling period. He got washed down a little bit by J. Michael Kelly and lost the canard wing at the front of the boat that is used to help prevent the boat from flipping.
Oh, no.
And then subsequently, as the boats were making their final lap before the start, Peabody encroached, took Tate's lane away after the score up, washed Tate down, caused him to lose power, and took him out of the mix at the start of the race. Peabody was subsequently assessed a 1-minute penalty for encroachment, which also took him from second on the water to seventh. And the net result of that was, even though it looked like a very tight race between Kelly and Peabody, with Peabody pulling even in the fourth of 5 laps in the final heat, it was actually smooth sailing to victory for Kelly, who was in lane 2 with the slower U11 Miss Mercury's Coffee inside him. Kelly nailed the start, led start to finish, Jamie Nielsen in that U11 finished second with Dave Vilwak in the U27 Missapolitan Mechanical in third, a podium finish for 70-year-old Dave Vilwak.
Who was second, did you say?
Jamie Nielsen in the U11 Miss Mercury's Coffee.
Jamie Nielsen? What's Mercury's Coffee?
I believe, I know it exists in Tri-Cities. I don't know if it exists in Seattle.
I believe that when I was driving home from the from Central Washington, we saw this boat on the way.
Nice. Jamie Nielsen, apparently a native of Fife.
Okay. Have to be from the greater Seattle area.
You don't have to. You could be from Detroit.
Okay, fair enough.
Remember the Central Washington University Hall of Fame? Highest career batting average in school history?
Oh, hello.
Played 1 year in the Royals minor league system? I
and
probably knew this
information
at some point.
Became a hydroplane driver?
Yeah, it's an unusual career path. I will concede that for sure. And the boat is based in Cleella. So, and that the highest finish ever for Jamie Nielsen, finishing second.
All right. Yeah, I definitely drove by this. We were driving along. Honestly, I thought it was like, because I never heard of Mercury Coffee before. And I thought it was maybe like some sort of like sponsorship boat. I wasn't even convinced that it was a real hydroplane. We drove right by this one.
Oh, I have looked this up. This is based on the east side. I guess they don't have a location in the Tri-Cities. They just have some beans available over there. But primarily two locations in Bellevue, Kirkland, three in Woodinville, four in Redmond, Bothell, Sammamish, and Falls City.
All right.
There you go. Tate's fourth place finish was his lowest of the season, but he'll still take a lead of nearly 1,000 points in the season high point standing into the final race in San Diego next month. All right, so I'm afraid we do not have a search for Seattle's best cookie this week. I did, thanks to the listener, Matt, for bringing Ben's Bread cookies to the meetup. They're a legit contender. We got to make sure that you have these, okay?
All right, you had me at bread.
I know I did. So with that, I guess it's time for your favorite segment.
Wow, we're here so fast.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
I was there at T-Mobile Park last Friday night alongside practically every other person in the city of Seattle. But let me set the scene for you. Home debut for Randy Arozarena and Justin Turner. Beautiful night. Crucial game against the Phillies, one of the best teams in baseball. The Mariners' biggest drone show to follow the game. Massive game. You know what that typically means for this organization. A loss was incoming. One, maybe two runs, a bunch of frustrating double plays, and a begrudging fan base would say, well, at least the Tigers are coming to town. But no. As I sat there watching my dog Humpy dance during the drone show, basking in the memory of three dingers and a grand slam, I thought to myself, we are so back. And then I thought, back how? Maybe this was one of those ludicrous situations where you're back for the first time, because for this organization, playing well in a big game definitely is not back. And how did they follow up that massive moment? Well, by losing three straight, of course, and the series against the Tigers at home. And tonight, as I watched Parker Meadows scale the wall and rob Cal Raleigh of a go-ahead homer, you know what I thought to myself again? We are so back. And you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. If you want to cheer for the winners, dog, the Yankees and the Dodgers both are in first place, have massive stars performing well, and have plenty of room on the bandwagon. But if you want to root for the home team, this is what we get. This is back. We get to live and die by every single August and September game. We get to watch the scoreboard and check every morning for the FanGraphs playoff odds. The SEC has no idea. They might say it just means more. Well, motherfucker, beating Chattanooga 66-10 doesn't mean much at all to anyone. But here in Seattle, Washington, with these Seattle Mariners, where we actually compete when we say it just means more, that's because every game means that much more. Every win is huge and every loss is a heartbreak. It has been that way for at least the last four Augusts and Septembers, and it has been horrible and it has been fun as hell, because even if the Seahawks are fighting their way through training camp, it just means more for the Mariners, because every night they're fighting for their playoff lives.
I mean, I think fans of teams like the Mariners often consider themselves like their team's unique in how frustrating they are, like the way they alternate good and bad performance. It's like, no, actually, this is just the defining characteristic of a 500 club, which is basically what the Mariners are. So, you know, you're going to have a performance like Friday nights where you actually hit and it seems like, oh, everything has been fixed by the addition of Justin Turner. And then you're going to follow it up by scoring, what, four runs in the next in a three-game span?
I don't think there is a fix for the Mariners.
Well, of course there's not. But it feels like there is every time you are successful.
I think there's incremental growth, and I think that Justin Turner and Randy Arozarena are part of it. The bullpen being shaky hasn't been great, but I do think that incremental growth, like when I watch this lineup, I'm not like, oh God, there's no chance of them scoring runs. You know, like Cal Raleigh hit the bomb, right? He hit the ball that should have won them the game. It's not impossible to have happen.
It would have given them the lead. I don't know that necessarily, and I don't think that Hernandez was coming in.
Munoz is coming in for the ninth. They would have won that game if he hits the homer. But there's a reality that they are a better team probably now than they were a couple of weeks ago, but they're not a massively better team. And there's almost no way in a baseball organization, no matter who they traded for, to have become a massively better team. And as Julio gets back, whether he's DHing or whether he's playing center field, and as J.P. Crawford gets back, those players are going, like, they're going to have a pretty solid competitive lineup every single night. Now, seeing when Mitch Garver trotted out on Monday night, so the Tigers don't catch the ball in center field, right? Blanco hits it to center field, the Tigers don't catch it, and you're like, oh, wow, there might be a moment happening here. And then up comes Mitch Garver, who strikes out to end the game just so unceremoniously. And it was like, okay, maybe Mitch Garver isn't one of those guys. But as Julio and JP come back, it does feel like this is a lineup that is going to have the chance to score runs every single night, which didn't feel like it was about a month ago. And if they are slightly better, you know, they're three games over 500 right now. Can they be slightly better than that team through the rest of the season? Probably. And can they make the playoffs? I think Fangraphs still is feeling pretty solid about them overall.
I mean, I suppose it depends how you define pretty solid. They're at 45% right now.
Oh, I think that went way down.
Well, yeah, they lost two games in a row to a bad baseball team at home. Not that that part of it really matters. And then the Astros won two games. So you said whether it's a DH or in center field for Julio, it's going to be a DH to start. The Seattle Times reported that on Wednesday night. So, which is going to create a bit of an issue.
They need
because
back desperately, though.
They already have two guys that are basically DHs on the roster.
Who are we counting? Turner and Mitch Garver?
I was counting Haniger and Garver.
I think that's a fine problem to have.
Is it? I mean, I guess it is if they all are really good at hitting. The problem is that none of them other than Julio are very good at hitting.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a fine problem to have because they just don't need to give Mitch Haniger those at-bats. We'll see how much longer Mitch Haniger's on the roster. As Canzone comes back with Julio getting healthy, there just aren't going to be a lot of at-bats to go around.
Yeah, I mean, there's also not going to be enough roster spots to go around because Cade Marlowe goes down when the first of Julio and Canzone comes off the IL. What happens when the second of those guys? Less clear to me.
I mean, what is Garver's contract? Does he pass this year?
Yeah, they just signed him. It's at least 2 years. I think maybe there might be a team option or a mutual option on the third year. And look, Garver just becomes the backup catcher at some point. Is a backup catcher, he's a great use of a roster spot.
Sure.
It's a lot of money. Haniger, the question is whether he justifies a spot on the 26-man roster or not.
Yeah,
and the answer is almost
certain. I have no idea exactly what a mutual option means. I assume that means it's a team option.
No, it means both would have to pick it up. So it means it's a non non-year at all.
There has never been a mutual option in the history of time.
I mean, I suppose there is some scenarios where a mutual option could work out. And usually what there is there's a buyout associated with it.
It's like
some sort of slightly different.
It's a figure. $1 million buyout, but it's basically a...
But again, that's 2026, not 2025. Yes,
no, there's another year of Mitch Haniger after this.
Garver. There's another year of Haniger after this as well.
Oh, God.
And that's why, even though Haniger probably does not, at this point, merit a spot on the Mariners 26-man roster, there's just no realistic way that they're going to waive him this season and forfeit the chance to get out of his money next year.
What do you do with Mitch Haniger?
You use him as your third DH, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, my
God. We'll
he's
see.
$15.5 million player option.
It's not ideal.
Oh,
not ideal.
That is a brutal contract the Giants signed.
I mean, I think so. If you're looking for reasons for optimism, which after the last two games, I don't think that Mariners fans are. I mean, look, my whole take a few
weeks
ago.
Everybody's looking for reasons for optimism. You're saying that it's all nihilism?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of nihilism or just coping pessimism, as I know. My argument that they should sell, besides maybe the Luis Castillo, maybe not going to be a great back end of that contract. Maybe it might have been the time to get out of it.
No, I don't buy that.
Just saying. The argument was the Mariners are doomed because their playoff odds are so low and J.P. Crawford and Julio Rodriguez are out of the lineup. They have managed to survive the period that Julio, at least, was out of the lineup. And that's obviously the far bigger loss. And their playoff odds are better now than when he first went down. So that's the upside. Astros haven't run away with things.
His whip is like a little bit higher, but you know, Castillo's FIP is lower than it was last season, where he was fifth in Cy Young.
I mean, it was a lot of like ground ball singles and Luke Rayleigh error when the Tigers were scoring off of him. It's just like, could go at any time with an older pitcher.
I mean, sure.
I mean, granted, we said that at the start of the season too with Castillo.
I'm not nervous about Castillo at all. You're way more nervous about Castillo.
I'm nervous about every pitcher. But
I mean,
especially older
pitchers. His hard hit ball rate has gone up since like 2022. His peak right when the Mariners traded for him has gone up, but it's precisely the same as it was last year. I mean, this to me looks like progress if you just saw these numbers. His line drive rate is down. His ground ball rate is higher. His hard hit ball rate is exactly the same. Home run rate is down. He's just... The opponent batting average is 20 points higher. And the BABIP is, you know, it was 302 in 2022, 268 last year, and 292 this year. Luis Castillo does not concern me at all. I mean, I guess there's just a lot of years left on the contract, but...
Yeah, I mean, long-term, it should concern you. Nothing about his performance this year. You're saying, I think it's a fair argument to make.
I spend so little of my time concerned about money that the Seattle Mariners are spending. How about that?
I'm aware that the money they spend affects their willingness to spend other money. So I do take concern in it.
But I also, another piece that you're probably not considering is the value for Luis Castillo because of that contract may not be as high as you think. The idea that you could quote unquote sell Luis Castillo and get value back might not be the same.
Might not. Yeah, that's perfectly fair. I do think that the evidence generally shows, especially in this year, which was clearly a seller's market, that teams are willing to ignore that in the moment.
The salaries?
Yeah.
They're not giving up prospects. That's the thing that people, if there were no top one, like they could have gotten basically like B or C tier prospects.
But well, I mean, Castillo. First off, the goal in trading Castillo wouldn't necessarily be the caliber of prospects you were getting back. It would be getting out of Haniger's salary was the way I articulated it.
And dumping both. That's a lot of money for a team to eat over the next 2 years.
I agree. Second off, part of the reason that no top 100 prospects changed teams is because none of the good players on the market changed teams either. Like, it wasn't Luis Robert Jr. and Vlad Guerrero Jr.
I mean, there obviously was a disconnect, but what are we talking about? Who cares? I guess is my main question. Who cares what they should have done? We're here now. The trade deadline's over. They're not trading Luis Castillo. Whether they should or they shouldn't have doesn't matter. And what does matter is the rest of the season going forward. And I think there are a lot of reasons for optimism, like you articulated.
Well, I articulated one reason for optimism. Not reasons. Reason for optimism. Well,
I mean, the other reasons for optimism are that Julio Rodriguez is coming back.
The AL West isn't, I mean, that was the reason already.
Your reason was that their playoff odds are better than they were beforehand. So
my reason was that
now you're getting into multiple reasons.
My reason was they had survived Julio Rodriguez's injury. You can only survive his injury if his injury is at net.
But a reason for optimism is that their playoff odds are higher than they were a week ago. Boom, that's a reason for optimism.
I mean, 2 weeks ago, really.
For sure. Was the deadline. 2 weeks ago. Is that they were they two games up over the weekend?
I know they were for sure 1.5 games up. I don't know if they ever got to two. Did the Astros play on Monday and win? That's a lot to ask here.
I think they did play on Monday and win. But also that the shit moves fast and is mostly random. Again, like the games have to happen on the field, but part of the reason that the Mariners are down in the AL West is because of a pretty incredible catch by Parker Meadows.
I mean, where I don't buy that is, look, their run differential is plus 22. Like, they're just not that good of a team. I think at some point we got to accept that.
What are Randy's stats since he's been here? You know, some of the doubles that he's hitting, he is an element. Where is he at?
Sorry, that was plus 22 entering tonight. They are now down to plus 18. They're directly ahead in the run differential standings of the Detroit Tigers.
In the 9 games that Randy Arozarena has been in Seattle, he has a much better OPS than he had in Tampa Bay beforehand, and a better OPS than he's had any season. Obviously, it's a tiny, tiny sample size, but since 2020, overall, Randy Arozarena is hitting well. They have a better hitter on the team than they had 2 weeks ago. That is a reason for optimism, period. They have, and okay. He's hitting well. And those games are basically half at home and half on the road. It hasn't been. They've been mostly in the heat. But they've actually been more at home than they have been on the road. And he had a double earlier tonight.
We're no longer interested in the Marine layer is so 2023 or even May 2024. Now it's all about the hitter batter's eye at T-Mobile Park. That's our do the meme. Friendship canceled with Marine layer. Now batter's eye is my best friend.
So he has 9 strikeouts. This doesn't include today's game, but he has 9 strikeouts before this 9 games. When he was in Tampa Bay, 101 strikeouts and 100 games.
Okay.
I think, fingers crossed, Randy Arozarena right now might be the exception that proves the rule for T-Mobile Park. And
I mean, if they find the one guy, then you can start to like draw conclusions from that guy.
I think they still just need better players.
I agree with that.
To me, I'm spending less time worrying about why the players that, you know, like 33-year-old Mitch Garver isn't playing well. Mitch Garver wasn't going to play well in Texas either.
I mean, Mitch Garver had played well for a long period of time.
A long period of time? But also, like, he's in that age when Mitch Garver could have fallen off.
Yes, but the single biggest risk with Mitch Garver was health, not performance, I would say. But again, to my point, the ballpark is also making all of the pitchers seem much better than they are. And the bullpen still doesn't seem that good, you know, at least the non-leverage part of it.
So which of these multiple years of Mitch Garver playing well do we want to bring up?
Oh,
are you
no.
ready for it?
Oh, no.
Was it in 2020 when he had a 5.11 OPS? That was only 23 games. Was it in 2022 when he had a 7.02 OPS? I mean, he's not that much worse. He had an outlier season, and the Mariners traded for him after an outlier season.
I mean, he had to say a better OPS in 2021 than he did in 2023. His career OPS was 7.88. So I don't know that I would describe 870. And that's you know, before this season. It was well over 800 coming into
he's
this season.
He's kind of slingshotted back and forth year to year, kind of like the Mariners have. So
that
maybe,
is, that
maybe
is not
they
inaccurate.
Count on him in 2025. Maybe it's 2025 is the year for Mitch. But like, you don't look at this and say, oh yeah, Mitch Haniger is definitely going to repeat Garver. These numbers. Oh, sorry. Mitch Garver is definitely going to repeat these numbers because he hadn't. He hadn't again, put together two good seasons for a long, long time.
But again, his career OPS was 825 coming into this season. That's what the expectation should be.
Most of his career didn't happen when he was 33 years old.
I suppose so. But the part that came when he was 32 was good.
Yeah, they signed him after an outlier season. Mitch Garver.
I'm telling you, it's not an outlier season.
For given his age, last year was an outlier season for him.
I mean, we can go look what his projections were. They're a shit ton better than he's actually hit. That's for sure. And as we have talked about before on the pod, the harassment that Mitch Garver described last week in Boston, like not even a baseball player. There's no scenario where anyone deserves that kind of harassment. No baseball player deserves that kind of harassment for their performance on the field, but especially not in a circumstance where it really has nothing to do with trying. He wants it just as badly as you want him to perform well.
I actually think, I'm going to throw this out there, I think Mitch Garver wants to perform better himself than any of us do.
That's fair. If you want to go with that, that's fair. So anyway,
who
stop being horrible
online. From? In Boston from Mariners fans?
I believe this was more online.
Oh, I was going to say, did the Boston get into the Mariners fans? What happened?
I don't think it was necessarily that series. He was just talking about it at that point. It seemed like a lot of it was also gambling related, which is a troubling trend, let's say.
I'm starting to think people might say some bad things on the internet. Based upon what you're telling me, if it's true.
But when you say it that glibly, then that justifies the behavior.
I'm not saying
you can't
justify
and normalize it.
Okay.
It's not okay under any circumstance.
I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying, like, it's there.
If we accept that is what it's going to be, then it will never change.
It probably will never change. Harassment on the internet?
I agree that it probably never will change. But I
think that harassment on the internet ends?
If we don't try to change it, it's definitely not going to change. I guarantee that.
The only way to do it is not looking.
I mean, I don't know all of this is on the internet. I mean, certainly some of this is what you're hearing from the stands at games as a player. I don't think that like not looking is the solution either. Mariners during that Red Sox series lost Gregory Santos. He's back on IL with a biceps injury. We mentioned Tom Canzone, due back, currently rehabbing in Tacoma. And the Mariners added Jonathan Hernandez from the Rangers bullpen off waivers. Not a great outing for him on Wednesday night as he walked two batters, allowed a hit, and all three of those came around to score in the ninth.
Bullpen's a little concerning.
It is shaky, to say the least. That's not in your list of reasons for optimism, the non-leverage bullpen arms?
I think the bullpen will be fine. I firmly believe this Mariners team's going to make the playoffs.
I firmly believe they're not going to make the playoffs.
Great. We have a difference of firm opinions.
Even Steven.
A difference of firmly held opinions.
And look how respectfully we did it.
Baseball is a complicated sport, though. It is funny. I mean, like, not that booing athletes in any situation makes them try harder, but baseball being the sport that trying harder is probably the worst thing you can do, is it does make it a little, like, effort is a negative. It makes the whole situation kind of complicated.
Well, team sport, golf and tennis, probably up there too. All right, let's get into the roundup. Seattle Sounders suffered a 3-1 loss Sunday versus Necaxa in Leagues Cup, yet still managed to advance.
Oh,
you were unaware of this?
No, I...
Were you aware that they played?
No, no idea.
Okay.
If we don't podcast for a while and I don't get invited to the game,
Obed Vargas opened the scoring for the Sounders in the eighth minute, and it looked like Pedro de la Vega had doubled it a few minutes later with a shot that deflected off a Necaxa defender and into the goal. But that was called back for offsides on Vargas early in the buildup after a lengthy VAR break. Necaxa then equalized in the 24th minute with a score outside the box, took the lead in the 44th minute, and added a third in stoppage time. De La Vega left in the first half with a minor groin strain after his previous hamstring injuries. Will miss a couple of weeks for Brian Schmetzer. Raul Ruidíaz is still out for the next League's Cup match, but Schmetzer is hoping he can be back when the Sounders return to MLS play after League's Cup. So the Sounders still advanced to the knockout stage as the runner-up in their group and will host the LA Galaxy on Thursday by virtue of a better league record over the past year. This despite the fact that the Galaxy lead the Western Conference this season, but they finished 13th in a dismal 2023. These teams played to a scoreless draw in Seattle in May, with the Galaxy taking a 1-0 win at home in March.
Would you assume that the Galaxy are probably the favorites in this match?
I don't think that they're better enough that they would overcome home field. No. But it's also one individual soccer match.
Mm-hmm. Between two teams who are relatively, like, one individual soccer match, you can project if it's France is playing against, you know, somebody who's whatever. Like, but for two teams that are evenly matched, pretty difficult to say.
Indeed it is, as the Olympic soccer results have been demonstrating, I would say.
Really? Tell me more. No horse.
The USWNT has made it through here, but Brazil in the final was kind of surprising. I don't know. I haven't really been following the men's tournament at all since the USA got knocked out, but it seems like every match goes to a hilarious, either extra time or a hilariously large number of stoppage time minutes. Is the sense I get. All right, Reign FC are out of the NWSL Liga MX Femenil Summer Cup. Peyton Linehan's goal in the 40th minute was the only score Wednesday as they were eliminated by the Portland Thorns. Reign won't resume NWSL play until August 25th. They'll do that with multiple new players. Another summer pickup for the Reign after officially adding Haiti captain Narelia Mondesir last week. It's Atletico Madrid forward Ana Maria Crnogorčević, the all-time leading scorer for the Swiss national team, who previously played in NWSL for the rival Thorns in 2018 and 2019, scoring 6 goals with 4 assists across those 2 seasons. Crnogorčević subsequently moved to Barcelona and had a big 2022-23 campaign with 8 goals and 6 assists in domestic play as Barca won the Champions League for the second time in her 4 seasons. She then moved on to Atletico Madrid last season, scored just once in 14 league appearances, 4 of them starts, and will turn 34 in October, but Reign badly in need of some finishing quality in front of goal, and Crnogorčević should bring some of that. All right, Olympic women's basketball update. We talked about this at the top, but Australia and the U.S. threw to a matchup in the semifinals. As we mentioned last week, the Aussies really struggled to start pool play. After losing to Nigeria, they beat winless Canada by just 5 points. So that made their final group game against France a must-win to avoid a stunning exit shy of the medal round. Tied at halftime, they outscored the hosts by 9 in the third quarter and won. In the quarterfinals against Serbia, we finally saw the play we expected from Australia, which led by 16 at halftime en route to an 85-67 win. It was a quiet night for Mezzi Megbegor, who had 4 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, but Sammy Whitcomb scored 15 points. Alana Smith had 22 and 13 boards. The reward is to face the USA in the semifinals, though they will be guaranteed a shot at their first Olympic medal since 2012, which was LJ's last appearance, even if they lose.
In a third place game, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
The bronze medal game. You know, the semifinals losers move to the bronze medal game.
Who's playing on the opposite side of the bracket?
The opposite side of the bracket is the two de facto home teams, France, the real home team, and then Belgium, which got to play the group stage games not far from the border in Lille.
Got it. Are there any challengers for the U.S. at all?
I do think if we see the Australia that we've seen the last two games, they are the toughest challenge for the U.S.
So this is basically the de facto gold medal game.
I mean, I don't know if I'd go that far. Like, if you're playing France in Paris, that's not going to be an easy game. But neither France nor Belgium has the size or depth that Australia has. I mean, Alana Smith and Essie Magbuor are two of the top four players in the WNBA in blocks per game. And they're going to have a chance to compete defensively against Asia Wilson and Breanna Stewart in a way that basically no other front court in the world is going to be able to. So, you know, if Australia can
still having avoid... a front court of Asia Wilson and Breanna Stewart's pretty good, though.
It is,
just
yes,
being able to compete against them is kind of like...
Something I didn't realize, we wrote about this game for ESPN.com. I think that'll be up tomorrow. Maybe not until Friday before this game, but Alexa Philippou noted in the intro that the Australia is 0-20 all-time against the U.S. in the Olympics. Like, this has always been the white whale, and even the one time that Australia did win a major international competition in the 2006 World Cup, back then the World Championships, it came because the USA lost to Russia in the semifinals and was cleared out of their path. So they've never really won one of these big head-to-head matchups. So last chance, presumably, with Lauren Jackson on the roster. She has not seen action in either of these last two games. Jewel Wood coming off the bench for the USA at this point.
It's didn't just play such a stacked team. Like, it's just not going to happen.
It would be quite shocking, but more shocking things, I would say, have happened than this.
What about in men's basketball? How is the U.S. team looking?
I think the U.S. men's team is probably more relatively dominant, but the field is way better. Because, I mean, my big question on the women's side, Australia
how can
winning...
somebody be more dominant? I need to question this. How can the field be better?
Okay, they're better relative to historic men's Olympic basketball teams.
Okay, I was going to say, if the field is better, then they're like it all rises.
Well, they also haven't played, other than Serbia in the opening game, any of these other, like, the best teams.
But your description was they are more dominant, but the field is better. You're dominant, like, relative to the field.
Yes, the USA women show a lot more weaknesses. They're, like, very bad at three-point shooting. The USA men are the best by far.
How is it that they're bad at three-point shooting? I mean, there have to be great shooters who could have been played for the U.S.
I mean, there are some. It's a very post-heavy roster, and then Diana Taurasi and Joel Lloyd have shot poorly in the Olympics thus far. They're a combined 3 of 27. So...
is Diana Taurasi, like, basically she's like grandfathered onto the team because of everything that she's contributed, but there are players who on the court would be better than her right now?
Oh, without question. Although she has played worse in the Olympics than you would have expected. Like, she's had a pretty good WNBA season. She's, you know, like a borderline top 25 player in the WNBA, but she has, like, basically not scored at all in the Olympics. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, top 25 is fine, but starting in the Olympic for the U.S. Olympic team should be like one of the top 10 players in the world.
Without question, yes.
Who would you have had on the
they
roster
put
instead?
Jackie Young in the lineup. Well, I mean, I would have had Caitlin Clark.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, right? How much they fucked this up.
I mean, it's probably in the end going to be a good thing for Caitlin Clark. She can use this month off, but...
winning a gold medal would have been pretty nice, though. And,
I agree.
And being an active contributor to the team.
I don't think she would have turned it down to get the month break. Let's put it that way.
They literally... who makes this decision?
There's a committee.
But I get... this is not saying they shouldn't have necessarily had Diana Taurasi on the roster, but if you have basically the most famous women's basketball player of all time, who's also playing well and in Olympics during her rookie season... seems like it kind of makes sense to me to make that happen.
I will say there's been less talk about it than I expected. Like, the attention has not been on her not being on the team.
Because they're winning.
But they were going to win either way, so that's not surprising. It's not like, oh man, they lucked out on that one.
You don't really see a chance for them losing either of these next two games.
I think it's more likely that the men would get upset than the women, even though the men's roster is better. Yeah. or at least relative to past men's rosters.
By Serbia or France?
Oh, Germany. Germany is
Oh,
by
sorry,
far the
Germany.
biggest.
And they would play Germany in the gold medal game.
If Germany beats France, yes.
I see. I think France is going to win.
You think France can beat Germany?
Yeah.
I do not agree.
What
But
is the game?
I definitely didn't think France was going to beat Canada, but that was also like super make or miss.
Isn't that the whole sport? When is that game?
That is tomorrow morning.
Ah. I see. Thursday morning, August 8th. No time listed here on ESPN. Okay.
It'll be 8:30 a.m. Pacific. So you probably will already have listened to this. This game will probably already have happened by the time you listen to this pod, but then there are a surprising number of early listeners. All right, UW football, not a lot going on of note from practice, which, as we said at the top, great news. No serious injuries that we've noted yet from fall practice. Huskies were the top team also receiving votes in the USA Today coaches poll. That was a little bit surprising.
I'll take it. I mean, we did play in the national championship last year.
We did, but given the other prognostications, did you see the Jed Fish t-shirt with the Where's Washington over a rankings? They showed a top 25 that did not have UW. And then over the top was superimposed Where's Washington?
Oh, okay. I like it.
But all right, on to the Seahawks, who
I feel
signed.
like Jed Fish has a little bit of attitude.
Oh, without question.
I'm pretty hyped on Jed Fish. We'll see. I mean, it's coming up very soon, just looking at the schedule. We're going to see a lot of Husky football at home too early on.
Indeed, we are. All right, the Seahawks signed center Connor Williams to a 1-year deal with $3 million guaranteed, a max value of $6 million after his visit earlier in the month. Should come in and be the starting center, you would expect, based on this contract, a position that Oluwatimi, the 2023 draft pick, and former Husky Nick Harris had been battling for so far in camp. Seahawks upgrading what looked to be their weakest position on the offensive line.
I mean, I thought this was a great signing overall. It, basically, I'll be pro any offensive line signing, especially if it's not for a ton of money. But given, I guess we could talk about some of the PFF grades for Connor Williams so far these last couple of years. And when you look at the roster, like those two names you're talking about between Nick Harris and Oluwatimi, being able to sign somebody who's kind of considered, at least by PFF, one of the best summer or one of the best centers in football, and to do it at this stage for this money is kind of an incredible move by the Seahawks. And I think this is a pretty underrated move overall, shoring up the offensive line.
As far as PFF grade per PFF Seahawks, he had the fourth best overall grade among centers over the last 2 seasons, second best run blocking grade. He spent the last 2 seasons with the Dolphins playing exclusively at center, all 26 games he played. He started at center after starting 51 of 57 during 4 years with the Cowboys, primarily at left guard. That came to an end when he suffered an ACL tear on December 11th.
Yet obviously the health is kind of the biggest factor there for this move, and this is why he was out there on the market until this point, but seeming healthy so far right now.
He passed some sort of physical when he visited the Seahawks. Still not totally clear exactly that you'll be able to jump right onto the field because that's an awfully quick return from an ACL tear. And then the other thing you wonder is, like, will that performance entirely translate coming off an injury? But the thing I like about it is the Seahawks signed him obviously way too late to count against their comp picks for this year. And if he does play well and earns a bigger contract elsewhere next season, they could potentially get a comp pick
Only
on the
be a
back end.
positive for comp picks overall. I mean, this is a massive move. I guess I'm not sure exactly what the ramifications are of the salary on the roster overall, but the reason he was out there and the reason the salary is what it is because of that injury. It's a risk and it's a gamble, but to me, there are certain positions that you literally cannot have enough offensive linemen. offensive linemen are going to miss games, especially somebody who's played center, who's played guard as well. You know, again, I feel like this could be an underrated move as the season goes on. We probably won't be talking about it, depending on what the record is. Week 8, week 9, we're not going to be like, but remember when they signed Connor Williams? But deceptively, I think this is going to be important with regards to winning and losing games for the Seahawks and how Ryan Grubb's offense operates in his first year.
The other bit of good news we got on the Seahawks offensive line front, I think this was Ian Rappaport who reported this, that Abe Lucas is expected back for the start of the regular season at right tackle.
Massive.
Yeah. So,
I mean, definitely some positive news on the offensive line so far. I mean, you could contribute maybe if there were some struggles from Geno throughout the season last year, the Abe Lucas injury being a huge one, having Abe Lucas 2 years ago, but not having him last year, I think it was a pretty big deal. So we also saw with Ryan Grubb at UW, I mean, he had one of the most acclaimed offensive lines in the country. You know, they won awards for the line as a whole, and they're pretty essential. It, you know, the offense will probably look a little bit different than the UW offense did last year, but having a good offensive line is essential to running this offense. It's essential to running every offense, but I think this is one that I'm sure Ryan Grubb is very excited about both of those things right now.
Yeah, it was amusing. They signed Connor Williams shortly after he talked about how well the two centers competing for the job were doing in camp.
That was
funny. Well, part of the way that they cleared room for that Connor Williams contract was with the restructure and extension of Julian Love. Those contract details are out per Over the Cap. It is, in fact, a 3-year extension beyond the current season. A total value of $33 million in new money, a $10.5 million bonus that buys down his base salary to $1.465 million this season, the veteran's minimum of $1.2 million in 2025. And then he'll also get an option bonus of $4.8 million in 2025. The Seahawks are almost certain to pay. No guaranteed money beyond that, which fits with their typical contract extension structure. If the Seahawks were to cut Love after the 2025 season, it would essentially become a 1-year $13.7 million extension. After that, pay as you go, with a $9 million base salary plus roster bonuses in 2026, $11 million in 2027. And then the deal also includes $1.5 million each in escalators tied to both interceptions and Pro Bowl appearances for my ESPN colleague Brady Henderson.
It's kind of a lot to pay for a safety overall. Especially seeing, you know, like Quandre Diggs and Jamal Adams, who wouldn't have made sense for to come back for the Seahawks at this point. But seeing those two players sign for so little money in Tennessee, a little bit more of a risk with each of them, especially Jamal Adams. But if Julian Love is good, we're not going to be thinking about this. And he's kind of proven himself on the field, at least last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows a couple of things. Number one, how much the Seahawks valued the interchangeable ability or flexibility that Love provides compared to Diggs, who is more strictly a free safety at this stage of his career, Adams, who is entirely a box safety, or in their view, a linebacker.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, part of what made Love so valuable to them. And then the other element of it is, I think they are projecting ahead to a bit, to a degree, like another projected huge jump in the salary cap in 2025. So even though, you know, the money was not there for guys like Diggs and Adams, there were some safeties this year who did make a strong amount in the free agency.
And it also shows how much they wanted Connor Williams.
Yeah.
Which I think is the right way to do it.
People always get excited about these restructures. We'll see.
I'm not excited about a restructure, but
you alluded
it's just
to
not
this.
That much money.
So Quandre Diggs got a 1-year deal with $3 million base and up to $2 million incentives, very similar in many ways to the Connor Williams contract. He's not coming off an injury, but just his age and a position that has not been valued by the league for the most part. You mentioned this at the top. Geno Smith missed 3 days of practice in a walkthrough while undergoing testing on knee and hip injuries, returned on Monday. So unclear if he's going to play this weekend against the Chargers as the Seahawks open the preseason.
I kind of can't believe they're opening the preseason already.
Yeah, we're here. We made it. Football is, I don't know if we made it, but football is starting.
It's just, it's so much more abridged also, it feels like. I guess the time period between the first game and training camp starting is about the same as it's ever been.
Yeah, I don't think that changed at all.
It just, it does feel like training camp starts and boom, they're playing games.
I mean, I think it's always been the case that the Hall of Fame game was the first weekend of August.
Yeah, no, I don't think anything has changed overall. But what day is that game, the Chargers?
I believe that is on Saturday.
Okay.
But it tells you how much I am looking, paying attention to it, that I do not know off the top of my head. Yes, it'll be Saturday at 4 o'clock. Jim Harbaugh will have to somehow figure out his show cause to get there and coach the game.
I have no comment about this.
It will be two consecutive games that Seattle football teams back to, because the Huskies played after the Seahawks last year, right?
What do you mean?
Like the Seahawks, the Huskies played the championship game on Monday night after the Seahawks final game.
Yeah.
So two consecutive Seattle football games will be against Jim Harbaugh.
Wow, that's kind of
crazy.
Different
leagues.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Justin Herbert is banged up. Not that he was probably going to play anyway.
Great. Scouting report for this one. They still have Easton Stick?
That's a great question.
I actually think I might have seen who the Chargers' backup quarterback was.
They added UFL, XFL journeyman Luis Perez at quarterback after the injury. Easton Stick is still there, yes.
There we go.
They also have Max Duggan and Casey Bauman.
I've never heard of Casey Bauman, but...
Nor have I. But maybe I have it, I just don't remember it. Oh, he played at Montana State, so no, I don't think so.
I'm seeing his college is listed as Augustana.
Yeah, I think he transferred.
I've never even heard of the college.
Me neither.
I feel like they must have, maybe this is all the case for everybody's preseason rosters, the quarterbacks from the most random colleges. North Dakota State, obviously, our dog Easton Stick, Texas A&M Commerce for Luis Perez, even TCU for Max Duggan, I'm Augustana, and then the team from down south.
I don't think I knew that Easton Stick went to North Dakota State.
Oh, you know I love Easton Stick.
I just only became aware of him when he showed up on the Chargers preseason roster.
Wait, really?
I think so. I don't know.
Wow. You're not in it like me and Luca.
I've played almost no college football at 25. And by almost no, I mean none.
It is kind of funny. You do learn, because of the transfer portal, like more random quarterbacks. Like I had a quarterback from Hawaii who's like a freshman, a redshirt freshman at Hawaii right now. And I'm like, well, this is now a person I'm aware of.
All right. Well, by the time we record next week, we will have an actual football game to talk about.
And cookies?
We will have cookies. I guarantee it.
And maybe you'll be healthy.
That I can't guarantee.
This is your flu game. But we won't have hydroplanes. How much of that did you watch, by the way? Is it on TV? Seafair?
Sunday was televised on Kong.
Okay. I should have turned that on. What the hell was I?
I don't know what you were doing. A movie, a couch, apparently. Well, that's going to be after this.
I still haven't identified what day I moved the couch.
You really haven't.
You think it happened just every time, every day I was moving a couch? It was on Saturday night that I moved the couch. Did I tell you Luca did it all state, by the way?
No, it was a 3-day process, I assumed.
Yeah, I had to see the Charles Barkley jersey and then go back and compliment the person on it.
Again, this is all going to be after you listen to this. But we recorded it earlier.
So they do like different challenges for all states. So right, these are like hypothetically, they're not exactly the 50 best kids at the age in the state, but they're like more or less the best, right? And they do like a speed challenge, not going to happen, not even close. I'm fast, he's not. They do a home run derby, did pretty good in. And they do like a gold glove thing, right? Where they just hit grounders at a player. First off, the machine broke for the home run derby, and they do like 10 pitches for 50 kids, right? So there's some guy who threw 500 pitches, and that's just for one age group. He might have had to do it for a different age group. Anyway, that was very impressive with regards to his
So you're scouting that guy.
Is what yeah, is an adult. But for the Gold Glove portion, he finished second in the state.
Wow.
And so it's like ground balls. You're playing it's basically middle infield, second base, shortstop. And you have to
not his usual forte.
No, that you have to field the ball and then make the throw to first. And there were a bunch of people who could field it, but they couldn't make the throw or whatever. And you just eliminate them. We call it King of the Infield, at their team's practices. And so basically King of the Infield, you're in until you miss it. Right. And he made it to the very, very end. There were two people left. And everybody was like, oh, these must be a couple of shortstops. And it's like, nope, the pitcher, first baseman.
Have you considered a position change?
I mean, he's not athletic enough to play shortstop, but just third base.
He could play third.
It makes so much sense. And I'm like, people. His coach was there. And I was like, we saw this, right? I mean, we think of him as an outfielder anyway, but it was pretty cool. But the thing that you got if you won is, I don't know what type of glove it was, just like a crappy glove or whatever, but they spray painted a glove gold and gave that to the kid who'd won. Wouldn't that be such a fun thing to have?
I know.
When you're older, if you're like, oh, here's, because at some point, everything that you do is just like, oh, here's this kind of crazy thing that I did, right? Having a spray painted gold glove from your 11U baseball season because you won at Allstate and you're basically could say you were the best fielder at your age in the state is a pretty cool thing to have.
Yeah.
So I was bummed. A Stanwood Cannon won. It's fine. I saw the last ball too. I wasn't there for it, but the last ball was it was pretty far. I was like, there's no way he's fielding that.
Did he pitch in the actual games?
He pitched fine. His stuff was okay.
Okay. Well,
He had a couple of nasty breaking pitches, but his command wasn't very good.
Well, that's the end of the baseball season, youth baseball season. We'll be back again in 2025.
Oh, it is not. Mateo's still playing.
That's true, I guess.
I've planned out children's. I had a conversation with one of the other dad coaches in the area, and we planned out everybody's sports for the next 3 years.
Did you?
Yeah, we've got. Well, mostly for the Mateo and his age group, but we've got basketball, football, baseball, all set. We know exactly what we're doing.
Are they all going to be your dogs?
My dogs? Yeah. Of course. Absolutely, they are. The football roster, I will say, talked about this last year, football roster, or last in spring, football roster is exactly the same for the fall.
I had a conversation recently with someone who covers the NFL about flag football, vis-a-vis 3-on-3 basketball. And whether grabbing flags is a skill. And I was able to point to my experience watching 7-year-olds play and say, oh, it is.
Whether grabbing flags, of course, is a skill.
I mean, logic demands it would be a skill, but yes, it is.
No, so this fall, we're going to be back with the exact same roster. Much more complicated playbook. Hello. Flicker offense. I mean, we already installed all these plays now. The kids understand. When you look at it from last fall, where it's basically run right, run left, no passing, to the spring when the playbook really opened up, and now by this coming fall, they already know the spring plays as much as they remember from them. So I think we're going to have, and we know what to expect too after playing in the championship game. It's one of those things, you get to the championship game, you see what that level of competition's like.
You get a healthy Mateo back in the lineup.
Yeah, no, he did miss the last few. They needed him too. And we also know to be mindful of not passing the line of scrimmage when passing the ball. So,
shouts to that one referee.
Yeah, no, I at the Allstate, there was another kid who was doing NFL flag in Covington, and I asked the parents, and I was like, do you know about this one referee who's the fucking Ed Hockley of flag football? And they didn't know who he was. And I'm like, honest. And they were asking me to describe him. And I'm like, you would know. You either, because they were like, oh no, it's only 15-year-olds or whatever. And I was like, okay, you have not seen this person then.
Absolutely not. We got to get him on the pod.
There's no missing him. I wish I knew. Honestly, I wish I knew what his name was. He would be a horrible podcast guest.
Oh no.
Because I guarantee you he answers everything as precisely as a question can be answered. Anyway.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
People attribute to taste what should be attributed to luck way more often.
People attribute to skill what should be attributed
and
to
skill,
luck way more
yes.
often. I mean,
and branding too. Branding, like, and positioning. That's the other thing. Like, people love to judge things based upon positioning.
I might not have the job that I have right now if the famous Cousin Katie hadn't spotted an ad in the UW Daily for an intern at the Sonics for their website. If
yeah.
she hadn't passed that along to me, who knows if any of this happens?
I mean, you basically need to have, like, the juice to do it. You know what I mean? You have to have, I guess by juice, I'm describing, like, ability or whatever.
Yes.
The Riz, as the kids would say.
Oh, no.
But, like,
I got a pitch today.
Oh God, did you?
Let me see here. Where is this? No, oh, man, this
can
is
I make an
taking too long
argument
to find.
Against my current argument, though? Because I sort of, at the same time, also believe that, like, perseverance is the only thing that matters.
I mean, it's not the only thing that matters.
Or is, like, the number one thing that matters. I was thinking of this
perseverance about... is, it's not sufficient, but it is necessary.
So there, I guess there are just a lot of ways of being successful at something, but, like, being persevering and being willing to, like, make your own opportunities is also important, because there are probably people who are out there who are just as talented as you or whatever, if you consider what you do quote unquote talent, but, like, who are just as talented as you at, like, stats and writing, or the combination of those two things. But there might have been other people who either didn't have the opportunity or weren't willing to, like, go out and do the thing. You know what I mean? Like, you did the thing where you were like, you hit up the BS cable or whatever to start writing there, and then you did a good
so
job there.
You're thinking of yourself, who didn't stick with the Denver Nuggets beat writer job.
But you
It was the
understand what I'm
Nuggets,
saying?
right?
I think it was the Nuggets.
You just weren't there, you know, is passionate about delivering breakdowns of Ryan Bowen and I don't know who else was on the
Was it
Nuggets at that
Ryan
point.
Bowen era?
I believe it was, as I was
I think it was
about the
Antonio
Sonics.
McDice part two on the Nuggets. The second go around.
Yeah,
we
that
picked up
sounds
a
right. It was
couch from somebody.
2001.
Here's a question for you. We picked up a couch. This is totally unrelated. But so we got a couch off Buy Nothing and went to this dude's house, and he was, like, helping loan in the car. And he was wearing the 90s Charles Barkley jersey, and it was, like, faded and everything. And I was like, there are certain jerseys that are the coolest jerseys that you could be wearing in the entire world. And Charles Barkley 90s Suns is, like, that's right up there. To me, I was, like, going through it, and I was like, Kemp, obviously. No offense to Gary Payton, Sean Kemp is easily the coolest jersey. That's why it's, like, people forget Gary Payton is what our head likes. Sean Kemp is what our heart likes. But
agreed.
The Charles Barkley 90s Suns, basically, I'm just describing 90s jerseys.
But not Jordan or Pippen.
No,
those
no.
Are
see,
not
they
qualified.
Were too big. That's the thing. They were too famous. I feel like Penny Hardaway, not Shaq.
I was going to say,
Penny
yep.
Hardaway, Magic, black
yep.
or blue. Vince Carter, purple, old school Raptors.
Grant Hill Pistons?
I do think so. The second era Grant Hill Pistons, the, like, teal one.
Okay.
That might be the end of the list. I could see a John Starks, maybe. I don't know. There's probably a few that are
too big.
But Starbury, like Timberwolves Starbury. I don't know. But I saw him wearing that, and I was like, this is, like, kind of the dopest thing you could be wearing.
Yeah.
Right? I was telling Keelan about it, and we were carrying the couch in, and I was like, just pretend that you're the guy with the Charles Barkley jersey. She had no idea what I was talking about. It did not even register to her that he was wearing a Charles Barkley 90s Suns jersey. But it was like, it wasn't like if you go to the Seattle Team Sports in the mall, they have literally those players I'm talking about. They still have those. And I went there today in Bellevue. But
what a busy day you had. Or was the couch not today?
The couch wasn't today. No, that was over the
okay.
weekend. But they still have those players, like the cool ones or whatever. But yeah, it didn't register to Kaylee at all.
Well, there
I
you
feel
go.
like that might be the Mount Rushmore is, wait, hold on. Definitely Kemp. Oh, wow. What about C-Web Warriors?
I mean, I respect if you had it because he was only there the 1 year.
Okay, the three that are guaranteed on there is Barkley Suns, purple Barkley Suns, Kemp, green Sonics. I'm thinking pre-logo change, the 95 and earlier, right? 94.
Yeah, even though those jerseys were not very good, the reproductions.
It doesn't matter.
I admit it. That's why
Penny
I said
Hardaway.
Know.
I'm not sure. I feel like the black one, maybe not the blue one.
I mean, the black one is just so much more ubiquitous. The Penny Hardaway blue jersey is my favorite non-Sonics jersey of all time, excluding nobody.
I'm trying to think if there's anybody else, because all the other like big, like David Robinson isn't cool. None of the Jazz players are cool.
Ewing, maybe,
Patrick Ewing isn't cool. I feel like Grant Hill might be in that. Maybe it's Vince Carter. Maybe the Vince Carter Raptors one is it. Maybe that's the, like, they're slightly different eras, but I feel like those might be the four coolest jerseys that you could wear, that you could stumble upon a person wearing. Because if it's too old, you're like, oh, this is an old head or whatever. If it's like 80s or something, if they have like a Dr. J one, you'd be like, it's cool, but like, it's a
little also,
too dated.
It can't be from the era. Like, there just weren't that many jerseys back then.
Yeah. No, that's this dude. The one that he had seemed like he had it from the 90s. It didn't seem like he like went to the mall and got a new one. You know?
What about Grandma Ma Hornets?
That was another one that I was thinking of too. I saw it today at the Seattle team store. Yeah.
There you go.
I do think the Vince Carter, like the just that Vince Carter was the coolest, because Luca brought up Tracy McGrady and I was like, dude, Vince Carter is a cooler basketball player. Like I feel like Vince Carter for a moment there was the coolest basketball player on the face of the earth.
Oh,
in the same
yeah.
way.
Without
that
question.
Penny Hardaway had a moment as the coolest basketball player. Begrudgingly to us at the time, Charles Barkley was and Kemp was.
Yeah.
Those are probably the four coolest basketball players for that time period.
So in conclusion.
I think that's the Mount Rushmore.
Success is more about luck and opportunity than it is skill or ability or talent.
Maybe. I don't, it's a complicated combination. But I do think grit and perseverance is part of it as well.
Yes.
Because to have the opportunities, you have to be there to get the opportunities. Like, you have to be working to get the opportunities. There are a lot of people who are very good at things that are sitting on, like, just sitting back and waiting for the opportunities to come to them. You know, I used to always think about this in like the South Side group, where it's like, yeah, there's a person who's really good at something, but they're like good at it just here, not in the like the real world. You know, they're good at it in SeaTac, but they're not like, they might be good at it in the rest of the real world, but they're like too scared or unwilling, like, to put themselves out there, you know? Or honestly, like, privilege is a big part of it too. Having the financial means to do that as well.
Without question.
So, I was watching Dodgeball earlier and Ben Stiller's character, he was like, I built this with my own two hands.
Globo Gym
and a sizable inheritance for my parents. And I was like, I love that they nailed that, the sizable inheritance.
Somehow a more relevant joke in 2024 than when it was. Is it this the 20th anniversary that they did it? Or is that 2003?
It is the 20th anniversary, yeah. I was telling the kids, I was like, we went in the Tri-Cities the day it came out, you, me, Katie, and Chris.
That's
the
correct.
Day it came out, 100 degrees. It must have come out in June, July.
And then it was
why
June.
Were we there?
We went there because, I mean, I know I went there, which is that the Storm were playing a game in Spokane.
Okay, so that was the weekend that we went there. I think I was with you,
correct.
And I just stayed in the Tri-Cities, and then you drove on to Spokane.
Yes.
And so it was just to hang out for the weekend.
Yes.
Or whatever. But I was like, we went on the day it came out, and then we played dodgeball nonstop. In fact, in hindsight, I don't remember.
We went and bought, like, balls to play dodgeball.
Of course. But I'm sure that we were pissed at you for going to Spokane for that basketball game because we couldn't keep playing dodgeball with you.
I don't think we started playing dodgeball until Sunday, in my recollection, but I could be wrong about that.
We were playing dodgeball. You were in fucking Spokane.
Okay. You say so.
It was like 100 degrees.
All right.
And we were playing dodgeball.
The Storm game was Saturday, June 26, 2004.
Wait, can you look up what day the movie came out? The release date?
Do I have to type in Dodgeball, a true underdog story?
Absolutely, you do. That's how I
Okay.
described it to the children. I'll tell you, they at first, it's.
It came out June 18th, so wow, our story does not check out. It was not the first day.
So we went a week later.
Yes.
Okay.
But obviously, we had to wait until we could all see it together in whatever movie theater there is in Richland.
That's so funny. Yeah, I don't remember what movie theater. I feel like I had no idea where I was.
Which didn't stop you from trying to walk home that one time
Over
when
the
you were
river.
upset. Yes.
Gotta have convictions.
That certainly required some grit and perseverance. I'll give you that, I guess.
I didn't actually walk home. Proving a point. Anyway, no, I did not pick up the couch today.